Okay, we'll move on to item eight.
So item number eight for board consideration is a resolution that would establish post-construction stormwater management requirements for the Central Coast region. And before we start, I want to announce that there are two supplemental sheets for this item. They should be in the board's packets. They were distributed to the public via LIRIS. And the first one was dated August 29th, and the second one was dated September 4th. Mr. Rock will explain the purpose of those supplemental sheets during his presentation. I'll turn it over to Dominic Rock.
Thank you again, and good morning. I'm Dominic Rock with the Central Coast Water Board, and I'll be presenting on item eight, the board action on a proposed adoption of staff's proposal to adopt the resolution for approving post-construction stormwater management requirements for projects, development projects in the Central Coast region. These requirements are necessary to protect water quality and are really the regulatory complement to substantial investments that the Water Board has made over the past 4.5 years to assist our region's municipalities in implementing low-impact development, as I think Dr. Inglis's presentation illustrated very well. The package itself, the agenda package for this item, has been available since August 15th, but we have since developed two supplemental sheets. The first was made available on August 30th, and another more recently, just a couple of days ago, we made another one available, and I wanted to make sure that folks who are here to speak may, that they have that second sheet so they can maybe take a glance at it, as it might impact what you're going to speak about. And there should be copies of them if you don't have any in the black bin back there. If not, let someone from staff know and we can get you that. So I don't know if the lights are, there we go, that's a little better, thanks. So we're recommending adoption of these post-construction stormwater requirements because urban runoff is one of the leading causes of water quality impacts in our region. And, of course, it's also required by the federal NPDES permit. The State Water Board's general permit for Phase 2 municipalities is a NPDES permit that requires post-construction requirements be included. And to date, we haven't developed those with any clear direction for the Central Coast. Managing the effects of urban runoff is not something we can continue to put off addressing. Every day that goes by, some number of square feet of imperviousness is laid down with limited or inconsistent measures to address the impacts that those surfaces will have on watershed processes, on receiving waters and water quality. Our region is vulnerable to these impacts because we have many watersheds that really haven't been developed extensively. And there's still the opportunity to develop them correctly and avoid some of these costs. So we have great potential to build out these watersheds, and we will continue to grow. These watersheds drain to remarkable, relatively healthy coastal environments that provide enormous recreation and tourism value to the region, clean beaches, good fishing zones in the coastal maritime environment, whether it's Monterey Bay, Estero Bay, or the Santa Barbara Channel. And finally, our region is dependent on groundwater, critical resource to us. We have over 80% of our supply is groundwater, and every surface that is laid down over a groundwater percolating area will limit significantly by maybe 2 to 7 times the amount of recharge or infiltration that would be recharging groundwater. We also need to recognize and really what some of the benefits are to pursuing a post-construction strategy. Dr. Inglis indicated a variety of these, and I think the questions from the board relative to the social impacts was also quite illuminating. But just in really practical terms about providing infrastructure to urbanizing areas, a lot of the measures that we are proposing result in lower infrastructure costs because you have to lay down less impervious surface, less concrete, lower cost in that regard. But there's also less conveyance infrastructure that needs to be developed. And these can potentially, by retaining more volume on site and dealing with stormwater where it falls or where it's generated, can actually reduce the infrastructure required for flood control, which will reduce the cost over time. And, of course, we have the potential to increase our water supply security by emphasizing groundwater recharge of stormwater where it's possible and where it's appropriate. And there's been plenty of examples kind of along the lines of the livability concept that was just discussed in the previous item, that there are actually improved livability and higher property values that have been documented by the United States Environmental Protection Agency in areas that have used low-impact development as a post-construction strategy. The Water Board staff began the effort to develop post-construction requirements in February of 2008 when we notified our permittees, the Phase 2 communities throughout the region, of the terms for enrolling under the 2003 general permit. So 5 years after the general permit was passed, we were still enrolling our Phase 2 communities. And in February, we indicated what we expected relative to post-construction requirements. And what we expected was that they would develop numeric criteria for post-construction requirement for post-construction stormwater management. We also commenced a stakeholder outreach effort at that time, or soon thereafter, and I'll provide a little more detail on that in a minute. And we decided that we needed to have a very strong scientific basis for developing criteria, and we secured funding from the State Water Board for almost $700,000, and we have expended almost $700,000 in technical work from highly qualified consultants from Stillwater Sciences, Tetra Tech, North Coast, or rather NHC, Hydrologics. Really, folks with unimpeachable credentials have been brought into this to provide technical research and findings to base our work on. And then we based the technical findings of that work as the basis for selecting numeric criteria. And we did that again. The staff ultimately selected the numeric criteria. But that was done in a process that was totally transparent with a technical advisory team from the municipalities and stakeholders observing that process and as we understand it, understanding it. The post-construction requirements themselves will apply to new and redevelopment projects that are completed under the authority of 38 municipalities in our region. That includes two University of California campuses and the city of Salinas, which you may remember is a Phase 1 community. All the others are Phase 2 communities. The requirements set these performance goals for runoff treatment, runoff volume management, and runoff peak flow control. Then they indicate how compliance can be achieved in a variety of circumstances where attainment of the goal may not be technically feasible. So they lay out a goal, but then they also demonstrate how compliance can be achieved if the goal cannot be met 100%. The requirements also focus on the parameter or the primary cause of impacts in urban hydrology, and that is impervious surface. So we set our requirements and associate them with the square footage of impervious surface, whether it's new or replaced, that's being created or replaced during urbanization. It's not retroactive. These aren't retrofit requirements. They apply to development as we move forward. And those requirements are scaled to the size of the project. So the smaller projects have lower requirements. Just some very sophisticated animation to demonstrate this at a very small scale, 2,500 square feet. We would require a site to do some site design and runoff reduction. This room is just under 2,000 square feet. So if you're going to go out and lay down impervious surface on an area larger than this room, we believe that it is reasonable and practicable to do some amount of mitigation in the design and the runoff reduction strategies. As we go up in size to 5,000 square feet, runoff treatment, water quality treatment requirements are put in place. And here is an area where there's not entirely new ground that we're covering. These requirements for water quality treatment have been in place in many of our communities already, possibly at a higher threshold of 10,000 feet. But we are basically kind of bringing our region up to speed with all the regions to the north and south and all the larger communities in the state by requiring water quality treatment being done at 5,000 square feet. And then at a larger project scale, greater than 15,000 square feet of new or replaced imperviousness, we introduce runoff retention requirements. These are volumetric requirements based on different rainfalls depending on where you are in the region. These requirements are cumulative, so a project that's 15,000 square feet will also be doing the water quality treatment requirement and will also be doing site runoff reduction and site design requirements. And then finally, at about a half acre, we introduce peak management requirements. Excuse me. Peak management requirements, which refer to matching the runoff peaks from storms from 2 to 5 years. These are not terribly different than many of the flood control requirements that already exist in our region. The post-construction requirements are really becoming universal throughout California and throughout the nation. They're going to be found in all the communities to the north and south of us in the metropolitan regions of the Bay Area and Southern California, because those communities are covered under phase one of the stormwater requirements. And these communities don't necessarily have to be enormous in size. They just have to, they could be as small as some of our communities. They just happen to be within an area where a phase one permit has been developed. And those areas to the north and south have been doing post-construction requirements for some time now. You're going to find post-construction requirements in the phase two stormwater permit draft that's on the street now that aren't terribly dissimilar to what we're talking about here. And you're going to see them in the construction general permit, which has actually been in effect for some time. The post-construction requirements of the construction general permit have only recently been come into requirement. They've been finally phased in after a couple of years. And even within our own region, there are communities that have existing development standards that address the post-construction issues that are addressed by these requirements. So areas such as City of Santa Barbara, the County of Santa Cruz have some fairly robust requirements in place that accomplish much of what we're talking about. So this set of proposed requirements we have put before you today really represent a set of minimum standards that can even the playing field within our region, but also with respect to regions just to the north and south of us as well. The requirements are an outgrowth of substantial stakeholder involvement and outreach effort by Water Board staff. We started early. We included a broad spectrum of interests, and we used a variety of approaches, both formal and informal, face-to-face meetings, web postings, workshops, convening the joint effort review team, the technical committee. And we have what we believe created a very involved and engaged and educated stakeholder community on this issue. In the staff report, attachment 6 includes a table that covers a list of milestones of our involvement, our stakeholder involvement process. These are kind of the significant milestones that you can review in that table that have occurred over the past 4 years. But they don't cover, the table doesn't cover the numerous informal meetings with individual stakeholder groups, including the building industry, the environmental organizations, and the dischargers themselves. We've had multiple meetings with dischargers Stormwater managers, a lot of those folks are in the room today, but the stormwater managers meet regionally in the north, south, and sometimes in the middle. And I've attended several of those stakeholder meetings in order to kind of advance and maintain communication with them. We've also, I've done presentations to professional societies throughout the region as well, of civil engineers and professional engineers. And I've also made presentations to elected bodies of municipalities throughout the region to ensure that the elected decision makers have an awareness of what the what kind of is at stake in terms of the federal permit requirement and the efforts that the Water Board is taking to develop a reasonable set of requirements to meet those federal requirements. Our outreach and education really should continue, and it can continue once these requirements are adopted. For example, the architects, which are a key building industry group that comes into a critical phase of project design early on, really needs additional outreach and effort, and I think that the Central Coast Lompac Development Initiative, the Water Board staff, and some of the municipalities can collaborate to improve on our education of that particular group. It is an important group. So stakeholder involvement doesn't end with adoption of this. It just continues as we implement the program. When we released the draft requirements on May 14th, it generated a substantial amount of public comment. We received over 300 comments and 35 different correspondences. And in what I would regard as a sign of success of our stakeholder outreach process, those comments were substantive, they were constructive, and they were detailed. And they allowed staff to make revisions to the requirements that actually reflect and respond to the comments themselves. The key issues that were raised in the public comment were technical feasibility of the requirements, what is the potential impact of these requirements on redevelopment and infill projects that many cities have been really under the gun to improve and to advance. What are the impacts of these requirements on the overall cost to a municipality, to a developer, to a public at large, the taxpayer? And, of course, what is the effect of these requirements on projects that have already been kind of initiated or some in the pipeline of approval within each jurisdiction? With regard to the technical feasibility issue, staff responded by making significant revisions to the requirements. We've provided a path for compliance for the sites that are most constrained by technical considerations. That path allows for runoff detention and release where retention is not entirely achievable. We have limited the amount of a site that has to be dedicated to retention-based controls before off-site mitigation is required. And we have replaced, revised the requirements for replaced impervious surface. So in even wherever there's a redevelopment project and you're replacing imperviousness, we've introduced an additional adjustment to further advantage redevelopment and infill over new development. These three adjustments, in and of themselves, address not only the technical feasibility issue, but by extension, they address many of the concerns related to the potential impact on redevelopment and infill, and they address many of the concerns about cost. But if we look at the cost issue as a distinct issue, staff also responded to that concern by removing requirements for complex hydrologic analysis. We made adjustments to the redevelopment and infill requirements by allowing projects within a urban sustainability area to effectively be off the hook for redevelopment mitigation of volume. We've also as I mentioned earlier, have restricted the amount of any single site that must be dedicated to runoff retention before an off-site requirement is waived. And we've limited the application and requirement of low-impact development methods to projects over 15,000 square feet, which by comparison to the Bay Area and LA and points further south is a considerable advantage to our communities. We also should remind you and others that there is evidence of the benefits and cost advantages of doing low-impact development. Many of those have been discussed, I think, in the previous item. But again, there's less conveyance infrastructure if you're decentralizing your stormwater management and doing more low-impact development. Facilities that you design tend to be smaller and take up less of the space of the site, potentially, and there's less imperviousness in general, so fewer sidewalks, maybe less sidewalks, narrower streets, translate into less concrete, less expense to a developer. With regards to the cost of these requirements on municipalities, or borne by municipalities, the Water Board paid for and led the development of these alternative or of these numeric criteria. We've spent over $700,000 in this effort, and this is completely unprecedented in the state, where regulations have been put out and water board or municipalities have been forced to go out, find the money among their own dischargers, and pay for the kind of analysis that allowed them to then implement the requirements. This is completely unique, and in terms of saving the municipality's cost, it's quite apparent that they've avoided that significant expenditure. We've also spent almost $2 million supporting the municipalities. I think Dr. Inglis pointed out some of the work on assisting them with code updates, design guidance, and the continuing work she's done with demonstration projects. And finally, of course, we've revised the off-site requirements so that they do reduce the need for alternative compliance by placing a 10% cap on the amount of a site that has to be dedicated to runoff retention, BMPs, or stormwater control measures. We, by definition, kind of limit where the final burden of cost is. Beyond that, if you put 10% of your site into this, or your impervious area into this, the off-site requirement is no longer needed. And where there's no off-site requirements needed, the need for alternative compliance mechanisms is significantly reduced. So in the revisions from the May 14th requirement, we have significantly reduced the amount of alternative compliance that's needed by cities. Furthermore, any consideration of costs needs to take into account the avoided costs. I think we can ask maybe the question, what are the potential costs to society, future generations of Californians, California taxpayers, of not addressing post-construction impacts in a consistent, thorough manner as described in these requirements? There are costs to infrastructure construction that we avoid. There's costs to repair of that infrastructure. And there's the significant avoided cost of restoring the impacts of that infrastructure. As the example of Elk Grove provided by Dr. Inglis is a good example of how proceeding with conventional stormwater design has ended up costing the city of Elk Grove considerable money in restoration. And, of course, the city of Los Angeles is now confronting significant cost to divert and treat stormwater because the infrastructure they've put in place over many years has really made it impossible to maintain water quality without those higher cost approaches. Another key issue was the effect of these requirements on projects in the pipeline that are in the development process already. And the first thing I wanted to mention was that we worked closely with city folks at municipalities who review development proposals. We worked with attorneys at the State Water Board and experts locally on the entitlements process, planners who work on the issue of entitlements. And we developed the language that you'll see on page 3 of the post-construction requirements. And those requirements, we believe, are a fair approach to ensuring that these requirements are applied in a manner that's timely and not cost prohibitive for a project in the development process. But we also want to point out there's 6 months of delay in implementation of the entire proposed requirements. And that 6 months is an opportunity for projects in the pipeline to adjust and potentially readdress their drainage infrastructure and design without incurring a significant cost of redesign. But we also revised the language. And the language now reads that there is the possibility of an exemption from having to apply these requirements in full for projects that have actually made some commitment and investment in their design of infrastructure for drainage. Our objective is not to penalize people who've already designed their infrastructure. It's to catch the projects that haven't yet designed their infrastructure and can be and that infrastructure can then be improved by these requirements. There are some unresolved issues, of course. I think today you'll hear about them from our speakers. I think many of them may revolve around the issue of the timing of implementation of these requirements. One suggestion may be that we delay implementation or perhaps delay adoption of these requirements until the draft Phase 2 general permit at the statewide level is approved. I wanted to point out that it's over 4 years late in being adopted already. While it is now scheduled for adoption sometime this winter, no one really knows when that'll happen. The post-construction requirements, however, within that draft permit are actually similar to the project, to the requirements that we've developed. State Water Board staff and Regional Water Board staff have been communicating and working collectively for several years now to develop a consistent approach to post-construction requirements. And so it's no big surprise that there's considerable similarity between the requirements.
Dominic, isn't there language in the draft statewide permit that...
And finally,
okay.
There's language in the statewide permit. And it specifically states that the Central Coast will comply with the state requirements by doing what the Central Coast Water Board adopts as post-construction requirements. This is a draft permit. There is no guarantee that this language will be retained, but that demonstrates to you the seriousness with which both regional and state water board have taken this issue and want to resolve it in a manner that's really supportive of the Central Coast municipalities. With regards to the second issue of delay, one suggestion is that a delay in implementation is needed because these requirements are simply too complicated, too hard to understand, and the preparation that cities need to make in order to implement is so substantial they need more than the 6 months envisioned. I just wanted to remind you that there has already been significant delay in implementation and in pursuing this post-construction requirements. Going back 6 months to your March 15th meeting, you agreed with Discharger's request to delay the hearing from our original proposed date of July 12th to today in order to provide them with more time to review the draft requirements, which were released on May 14th. Now, that adjustment to the hearing date allowed staff to provide them with an additional 3 weeks of review of the May 14th requirements. And it also resulted in a delay of, we had to push out the implementation date. So we're now, that delayed by 2 months the original date for implementation. So there's already been some delay. But there's also been significant preparation on the part of the joint effort municipalities. And we have actually prepared for and built into the process a schedule that allowed them to prepare for this inevitability, which would be the adoption of post-construction requirements. To go over some of those, I just wanted to say there are over a year and a half of administrative implementation that's been taking place. And that's included very deliberate steps, such as training staff, developing guidance to development community, educating outreach of the target audiences, the development community, and even the staff in municipalities will be implementing these regulations. Evaluating the municipal codes, we've kind of gone over that a little bit of how we've assisted them in actually going through their municipal code to determine what aspects of it need to be revised. We've also had over a year and a half of on-the-ground LOMPEC development implementation, so the experience of approving a project with requirements for LOMPEC development has been in place for over a year and a half. There's been over between 2 and 4 years, depending on the community, of runoff treatment requirements. So as I pointed out, these aren't an entirely new set of requirements. There's some experience doing that. We've had 4 years of stakeholder outreach, and the Central Coast municipalities have had the distinct advantage of watching folks to the north and south pursue post-construction requirements that have been in place in those regions.
Dominic?
Yes.
So when in this list of milestones, some of those are referring to practices or work that's gone on in outside of our region. Is that what you're saying?
No. The last bullet just is wanted to point out that there's an advantage to having everyone outside the region,
right.
Not everyone, but, you know, these areas north and south,
right.
Pursue the implementation of post-construction requirements, because the development community, the municipalities can all look at that and say, okay, this is either working, here are the rough spots they're encountering, and that's an advantage to our communities.
Sure.
And in that sense, yeah. I think it prepares them better to begin start this process of implementing.
Sure. So there's always lessons learned and that can be gleaned. But
right.
Then what you're telling us is that there's been 2 to 4 years of runoff treatment and 1.5 years of LID implementation. Are those in places like Santa Cruz and Santa Barbara that you referred to earlier?
They're everywhere. The point I wanted to make about the first few bullets on that list is that these are actually requirements of their stormwater management plans that were conditions of approval or conditions for their participation in the joint effort process was that they would commence implementing low-impact development in an interim fashion, that they would do all the training of their staff, that they would begin evaluating the municipal codes. These were actual commitments that are in their stormwater management plans, their actual permit requirements. So the point I'm making is the joint effort was constructed in a manner to prepare them in an administrative fashion for the ultimate adoption of a set of numeric requirements that, if you hadn't been preparing for, would be quite difficult to just suddenly deal with.
Mr. Chair.
So, you know, also your consideration, the board's consideration of the option of delaying implementation of this effort, really, I just want you to consider what those potential costs of delaying are. And, you know, we can't state them with any certain accuracy what the cost to the water quality will be, but we believe they're not trivial costs, that the projects will impact water quality, that there will be some area of pavement laid down in our region, several thousands of square feet, no doubt, probably best measured in acres, that are not being mitigated in a consistent fashion and are not providing all the benefits that we've been talking about. And those changes to the landscape are not temporary. These are permanent impacts, unless you want to go in and remove imperviousness or address the impact of that imperviousness after the fact, which is exceedingly expensive. So our suggestion, of course, is to do it right from the start, to begin this process and really start to take advantage and reap the benefits that this approach should garner. Upon adoption of the post-construction requirements, the executive officer will send a letter to the permittees transmitting the requirements. We will also make we'll extend some of the relevant schedules that are built into their stormwater management plans that have been affected by the subsequent or the earlier delays. And then the municipalities will begin implementing within 180 days, which will be March 5th, the post-construction requirements on all projects to which they apply. The Water Board has also made commitments to prepare supporting information and support to the municipalities, including a user's guide to help them take the requirements and actually interpret them into their own development process. We're also prepared to provide rainfall statistics for the 95th and the 85th percentile, storm events to just completely resolve any challenge or cost that they may have in developing or securing those statistics. And we've also have very close to final the stormwater control plan template that will enable them to essentially take a existing document and use it to meet the requirements for stormwater control plans in these performance requirements.
Before you get off that slide.
Yes.
Mr. Jeffries had a question for you, and then I've got one also.
Sure.
Dominic, my question is, and wearing one of my old hats as a mayor of Salinas, is that I know to change a code or an ordinance city, the shortest possible time would probably take 6 months, probably to a year and a half. And I just heard you say from the time this is approved to implementing this would be 180 days?
6 months. Yeah.
Well, 6 months. And then the second part of the question is, how do we know that the cities or the municipalities are interpreting and their new code changes or ordinances that meets these requirements? And so, which would relate back down to the local community and developers, because they're going to be looking at those codes and those ordinances to do their type of development. So that's, you understand my scenario?
I do.
Okay, can you respond to that?
Certainly. With the first question of providing only 6 months to develop the implementable, enforceable mechanism for the requirements, I think what I've been trying to get across is that these municipalities aren't just starting from scratch. There's been significant effort over the past couple of years to prepare them for code revisions and for adoption. The process of first reading, second reading of an ordinance, approval by different decision-making bodies, and final approval at a city council can take as long as you've indicated. But in terms of preparing for what needs to happen, they're in a really good place to potentially take advantage of that full 6 months and get it done. So that's our expectation, is that they could do that.
Before you answer his second question,
mm-hmm.
have you, on that first question, have you received specific feedback from any of these municipalities that they can't comply with a six-month turnaround time?
We have heard that, yes, that's the position that many of them are taking. But not in the comments. It's just in the kind of the background and interaction and stakeholder involvement we've had that they feel that's an aggressive schedule.
What is there any kind of average number of months that you've heard that would be more workable for?
No, we actually picked 6 months because that was a figure that people have put out that takes about 6 months. In fact, I believe Mayor Jeffries may recall that 6 months, you've said that could be done. I think other members of the board who have been involved in municipal actions have probably an idea of that as well. It's hard to give an average, though.
I didn't mean to interrupt
you,
Dominic, but I just wanted to let you know that when I said the 6 months, that would be that if everything went very smoothly. There wasn't a whole lot of objections from the local community.
Right.
It doesn't mean that normally you could pass every ordinance a code change within 6 months, because that is not realistic in most cases. Because the time that you go through your presentations and your planning commissions, hearings, and for their recommendations, approval to get to the city councils, and after you hear the first draft or the second draft, And then you have your legal staff all involved to make sure that it's all legal, meets the requirements, and then you finally implement that. That's what I said, it could take up to a year and a half, at probably maximum. That would be more an extreme. But then you have the other part of the equation, as we all are feeling it, is the economy and the crunch. As we know, within our own staff, we've been downsized, and as cities have and counties have as well. So, you know, I know that you're trying to do 6 months, but I don't really think that's realistic in this day and age, need to say.
Okay. With regards to your second question, as I understand it, you're saying what assurance do we have that the adoption of an ordinance at a city by a city will actually be a accurate interpretation of the requirements as set forth in the post-construction document. And that is kind of a challenge that we're going to confront regardless. We don't have the ability at the staff level to review all of the ordinances and ensure that they represent the enforceable mechanism. What our approach would be to examine a handful of them and assume that they are, make an assumption that they are actually pursuing with adoption of enforceable ordinances. But, you know, take a sample of those and review them to kind of determine whether we see that mechanism in place. And then over time, if it becomes apparent through the city's implementation of the program that they, in fact, are not requiring their development projects to adhere to the standards in the post-construction requirements, we'll know that there's a problem, and we'll have to proceed with, the potential for violation or enforcement action. But it's not something we can ensure happens before it happens. That's going to be tricky. And that's a problem that is essentially attends all the post-construction requirements that have been adopted in the state. They have to be turned into an enforceable requirement by another municipality or by another entity. And that translation is, you're right, it's vulnerable. We're vulnerable to some abuse there. I would just want to conclude, I believe, with one or two more slides. And just tell you that while we've made substantial revisions to ensure that these requirements are implementable, we make no claim of their perfection. What tends to happen is that post-construction requirements evolve over time. You start somewhere, and then they change and they adopt. None are perfect upon adoption. They've all initiated a period of clarification and adjustment, revision, and evolution, and what is before you is really no different. I think an illustration of how they evolve might be the Western Washington stormwater requirements, which have been in place longer than anything else on the West Coast, which have been a model for many of the phase ones in California, and which are now over 3 inches thick. I mean, there's just a substantial amount of growth of that particular program over time to address all the issues that will come up and have come up. Neither the water board staff nor the stakeholders have the ability to anticipate all of the development scenarios that might come up and create some hitch or unexpected obstacle to implementation. But we have anticipated the vast majority of development scenarios, and we've addressed them and provided clarification and guidance on how to comply with these requirements in the face of those unique, relatively rare situations. The point is to get it right for the vast majority of projects to start. So since 2008...
Hang on, yes. Dominic. Dr. Hunter?
Yeah, I... pardon me. I just want to... clarify for myself something that you just said. So effectively what you're saying is looking at the Washington model, where it started and where it is today has expanded and evolved as the experience of the specific kinds of constraints or challenges or barriers to accomplishing compliance have been better defined. So it's taken time for that process to occur.
Right.
And what I'm hearing is that you feel that our post-construction requirements are going to follow that model, that we will also have the ability to be responsive to what we might call unanticipated barriers and to think through and relook at how to modify and adjust so that we're dealing with conditions on the ground here. And so that's part of the way these post-construction requirements are constructed through the stormwater program. Is that how it works?
Yeah, they're by definition, it's an iterative process. You put in place a requirement, and you have to go back and revise it. This is happening in our state as well, not just Washington. I think we have an advantage in having seen what Washington State has done over time, having seen what the Bay Area and Southern California are engaged in, of not having to start quite from the same place. We're starting from a much better place, and we don't expect the same amount of revision and evolution, but there will be changes. That's all I wanted to point out.
So just so I'm clear, as these standards move through the ordinance process, which is where they become enforceable, and where these unanticipated barriers emerge, there's a time frame in there between recognizing a problem, bringing it up to the water board, or just go to the municipality and they come to you, before any kind of enforcement occurs. What is that process going to look like? Because I think I'm hearing two things. One is we want to be able to get to enforceable, an enforceable set of standards, which means there's consequences for noncompliance. But I also want to understand where the latitude is, where is that flex in identifying elements that haven't been fully addressed and that need more. And that's part of that evolution of how that criteria looks. Where's that flex in there?
It's a challenging question to answer. I think if we look at how other regional boards have approached it, they've set out a set of expectations and timelines according to their adopted permits. And where municipalities have had challenges, they've come forward and said, look, this isn't going to work. We need more time. So in that particular instance, the water board will delay implementation of a particular component. This happened in Ventura County recently with regards to developing the alternative compliance framework. They gave them more time to develop the framework before those requirements were put in place because upon adoption, they really hadn't envisioned the complete level of complexity that they confronted. Mm-hmm. So water boards typically wait for the municipality to identify the area that's of greatest need for addressing, and they develop an approach collaboratively. Our objective is not to, of course, begin enforcing on people because they don't meet the letter of the law. Our objective is to improve water quality. Right. And if we recognize that there is a more constructive path to getting water quality than proceeding with an enforcement action, the water board has always demonstrated that ability and flexibility. I can't provide you a better picture of how that process works other than sort of by those examples of how we've approached it in the past. I don't know what level of revision will be required and when in this particular program. As I pointed out, we've really, really strived to address all the major issues so that implementation can actually commence. Mm-hmm. And it may be several years before we see a big issue that, wow, we need to go back into this. Mm-hmm. But I don't envision a quick revisions needed in the next few months or anything. I think that'll be a while before the municipalities and the development community potentially reveal what it is about these that may constitute something worth revising. I don't hope that's an adequate response, but
I do understand what you're saying, and I am glad to hear that that's the approach. And I also wonder about the joint effort. if that has also been the message, is this is iterative, this is a collaborative process, and that, as you said, outreach needs to continue, and so will the joint effort continue on to provide that forum in which to really hold those kinds of reflective discussions where, you know, the rubber hits the road and people are starting to actually see the constraints.
We have not developed our sort of post-adoption stakeholder process or framework for engagement. You know, we typically enter kind of a new phase of implementation when we adopt a permit or a set of requirements. So we have not constructed that because we haven't adopted anything. But I would anticipate that there's no possible way for us to just disengage. Mm-hmm. We are going to be engaged with our and providing oversight of this program. I don't know if Phil wants to say something. Mm-hmm. This is Phil Hammer with the Water Board.
I supervise the stormwater unit, and just yesterday I was going through an exercise of kind of prioritizing all our tasks in our unit and the joint effort kind of implementation. It might not be called the joint effort anymore, but just post-construction requirement implementation was the highest priority for our unit. And, you know, I allocated a substantial amount of resources to basically continue the momentum that we've created through this effort, the joint effort, and the low-impact development initiative. So we're committed to having the process continue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Johnston has a question.
Yeah, Dr. Hunter hit most of what I wanted to ask about this. I like the idea of viewing this as an iterative process, viewing essentially the regulations as, if not a living document, at least something that we recognize we're not going to get perfect the first time. And, you know, your example of how that would work was a city needing more time to comply with an element of it, and that's fine, but I would really like to see a kind of a circle back with the stakeholders in at some point in a few years down the road, once this has really had some chance to be implemented, to get collective rather than individual municipal input as to what's working, what's not working, what needs to be considered for change. I just think it's a better process. I'm you know, at this point, pretty impressed by the process that's happened so far, and it would seem a shame to lose that aspect of it.
I appreciate that comment.
Mr. Jeffries.
I understand that.
Dominic, I have one more question for you. Since a lot of our communities are on the coast, have you been working with the Coastal Commission on these rules and regulations, and how does that blend with their rules and regulations?
Yes, we have been working with them. At least we've initiated the process of working with them. We've had a meeting with their water quality division staff here and had several subsequent phone conferences to try to ensure that the Coastal Commission recognizes that the Water Board's requirements are protective of coastal resources. That's a number one priority for them. But in terms of the process for the Coastal Commission to review the ordinances, that remains to be seen. They do have that that responsibility to address revisions of local coastal plans.
Well, my concern is that if a developer does everything that we require them to, and they go then to the Coastal Commission for final approval, and the Coastal Commission says, no, that's not acceptable.
Right. We don't want that to happen either, which is why we've started talking to them about the specific requirements themselves. The Coastal Commission wants to move aggressively on low-impact development and post-construction requirements as well, but they haven't put the same amount of effort into selecting those requirements as the Central Coast has. And so what we want to ensure is that they recognize the effort we've made is actually probably better than anything they might try to do independently or subsequently. That's overall intent, and it remains to be seen whether we can, you know, really get that kind of cooperation and pay off with them.
Hopefully it does work.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Well, I just want to emphasize that that's an important point, that, you know, a lot of criticism is heard today about, you know, duplicate regulations, by agencies, and this is a great opportunity to try to get the Coastal Commission on board, at least with adopting what we have developed and not trying to recreate something that might be conflicting or more restrictive.
I agree.
So I hope that's, Phil, part of your allocation of some resource is to go beyond just kind of setting up the contact with Coastal Commission, but following through, because I would like to get some status report back from you guys next year.
Okay, we can do that.
Yeah. So we know what the status is on the Coastal Commission's reaction to what we're doing. I'd like to know whether they impose any stormwater LID requirements in their coastal development permits. I have no idea.
My understanding is they do. And we have talked to them, and generally in our discussions, they've been looking to us to find out what we're doing so that they can learn about what's the appropriate level of requirements. So, I mean, they are not necessarily going off in a different direction than us. They're actually talking to us just to learn about what we're requiring, and they see us as a resource to guide what they're doing. So I think we're in sync, and we'll continue to work with them, and we'll report back to you.
Well, make sure with whatever we do with this resolution today, if it is passed in some form, that the Coastal Commission is informed of what we have done.
Yeah. No, that's we're way involved in that.
Good. Yeah. Well, I just want to make sure.
In fact, Tamara Doan, who has been our contact there, has been trying to keep up with the each draft that's developed, and sent her regrets that she couldn't be here actually, but she just talked to her yesterday.
Good. Mr. Harris.
Dominic, would you comment on the nexus of the LID requirements with the requirements for ASBS areas? I think that's really important.
Yeah. So the ASBS requirements are a part of the
Dominic.
Ocean Plan, and that is the areas of special biological significance. And those are, so they're a special designation of coastal waters that are particularly high value, high sensitivity. And they have garnered their own protections under the Ocean Plan. For water quality protection. And some of our region is subject to that, Pacific Grove and Carmel and the areas in the Monterey Bay Peninsula in particular. So one of the ways that we've kind of framed this is that the implementation of low-impact development strategies and robust post-construction requirements actually fully support the objectives of these protections of the ASBS by potentially addressing most of those issues of contaminated runoff and, contaminated runoff primarily. If we, through our implementation of low-impact development, are reducing the amount of volume, polluted volume runoff that's entering these coastal areas, we are basically advancing the ASBS. We don't see a conflict of any sort between implementing these post-construction requirements and what those specific municipalities are up against in terms of complying with the ASBS. So that's maybe you want to add something to that, Mr. Harris?
No, I just wanted to bring that up because I think the LID requirements are a direct benefit and are going to assist many of the cities who have to deal with the ASBS requirements. Thank you.
Yeah, that's kind of how we see it. So I wanted to conclude with this slide and the final recommendation and just point out that since 2008, we've actually been working hard on this. We've devoted money and time. $1.8 million has been invested in technical assistance through the Central Coastal Impact Development Initiative. That has actually resulted in leveraging additional $3 million in bond funds for projects that I say on the ground there, I should probably say approaching or coming in for a landing. They, some of them haven't actually hit the ground. The 21st Street project is an example of one that potentially will break ground next year, so that's an example of very close to on the ground. But some of these other funds, Atascadero Zoo and other projects, are still kind of in the planning phase. The requirements before you are necessary to protect water quality to the maximum extent practical. And they serve as the regulatory complement to all of this groundwork which we've laid with this technical assistance and implementation of assistance to municipalities. We would recommend that you adopt the post-construction requirements as modified by the two supplemental sheets. And with that, I conclude my presentation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. What we will do is take a break for 10 minutes. And I have 14 speaker cards for this agenda item. When we return, we'll begin with John Boggs, then Stacy Lawson, and John Falkenstein. Those will be our first three speakers.